Last time we were together, we began the book of 2 Samuel, which is just a continuation of the stories in 1 Samuel, in particularly the death of King Saul and Jonathan and what happened to their bodies thereafter. So I want you to open to 2 Samuel chapter 1, and we're just start over again at verse number 1. After the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. So we know that David, chronologically, arrived back at Ziklag the same day that the Battle of Mount Gilboa was taking place. This text tells us that he was there the next 2 days after that. And then on the third day after the battle, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. So we know that it took David 3 days to go from Jezreel Valley down to Ziklag. It also took this messenger 3 days to travel from Mount Gilboa, which is also Jezreel Valley area, down to Ziklag. And he's bringing the message of what happened to King Saul. He's covered in dirt, probably because he wants to show his own grief to David at the death of King Saul and Prince Jonathan. So when he came to David, he fell to the ground, he paid homage. So he treats David as an important, powerful leader. That's important to the story here. Verse 3, David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said, "I've escaped from the camp of Israel." David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." Because David hasn't heard. And he answered, "The people fled from the battle, and also many of the people have fallen and are dead, and Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." So David finds out that the fight was a rout, and a lot of Israelis are dead, and that Saul and Jonathan are both dead as well. Verse 5, then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" So he wants to verify. You're not just passing on rumors, are you? Did you actually see it happen? How do you know for certain that they're dead? That's the question. And I already told you last session, I'm going to tell you again. I believe that what this guy says next is a total lie. And here's my reason for it. We already read at the end of 1 Samuel the inspired account of Saul's death. He was mortally wounded by arrow fire. He wanted his armor-bearer to end his life so that the Philistines wouldn't be able to capture him and torture him and all of that. The armor-bearer wouldn't do it. So the prophetic author of 1 Samuel said that Saul fell on his own sword. That's very clear information there. And then the armor-bearer killed himself, and that's how they all ended up dead. So that's the inspired information. This guy tells a different story. This guy is lying. But he's lying for a purpose. He wants to get in good with the next king of Israel. Everybody understands that David was the popular person in the kingdom of Israel, even when Saul was king, and that David was running away from King Saul because King Saul feared him becoming the next king. And so everybody is pretty much apprised of this reality. David will be the next leader of Israel. And so this guy wants to get in good with him and get stuff from him. It backfires on him. So the young man, this is verse 6, who told him that Saul and Jonathan were dead, spun this tale. By chance, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa. Now, I don't believe that one tiny bit. We're about to be reminded that this young man is an Amalekite. The Amalekites are notorious slave traders. They engage personally in kidnapping people that are in places that can't protect themselves, and then they sell them on the slave market. But they are also known to buy prisoners of war. And so I believe this guy was part of an Amalekite group of scavenger types. That's the best way to describe them. That followed the Philistines up to this battlefield with the intention of buying slaves. Well, this particular guy was wandering around on the battlefield after Saul was dead and comes across his dead body. But he tells a different story to David. So back to the story that he's spinning. It says, by chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa. There was Saul leaning on his spear, you know, as if he's still alive. Behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. So apparently Saul's the only one that's alive. There's no mention of his sons. There's no mention of his armor bearer. It's just Saul there, mortally wounded, leaning on his spear, being closed in on by the Philistine forces. Very dramatic, you know. When he looked behind him, he saw me, he called to me. And I answered, here I am. And he said to me, who are you? And I answered, I'm an Amalekite, which is just so ironic to this situation, because Saul was abandoned by God because he didn't finish the punishment against the Amalekite people. And so here is an Amalekite that survived that campaign 17 some years ago, when Saul was supposed to eradicate the Amalekites. And so Saul is supposedly asking for an Amalekite's help in killing himself. So he said to me, stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers. So basically, I'm mortally wounded. I can't kill myself. I need you to help me. And so the Amalekite young man tells David, so I stood beside him and then I killed him because I was sure that he could not live after he'd fallen. So I was positive he was mortally wounded. And so I decided to help him. Now, here we get to the real thing. I believe this next part. I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm. Now, he doesn't take off his armor because the Philistines will find armor on him. I believe this guy finds Saul's body before the scavenger patrols of the Philistines found the body. So he says, I took the crown, marking him as king, off of his head, and I also took a little armlet off him, which probably another indicator of his position as king. And so I brought them here to my lord. So I brought the emblems of kingship here to you, sir. I'm the one that's going to help you get crowned. That's what's being communicated. And he fully expects to be rewarded. Then David took hold of his clothes and he tore them. And so did all the men who were with him. So David grieves over the death of King Saul and also over the death of his close personal friend, Prince Jonathan. And his fellow Israelis also grieve, I think probably more over Jonathan's death than over King Saul's, because some of these same guys would have wanted Saul to be killed you know, by David earlier. We know that in the text. But when it all boils down to it, King Saul was the king of Israel. And no matter how he changed over the years that followed, many of these guys have been in King Saul's military up until about 2 years ago when they left with David. And so they feel that they should acknowledge the tragedy of the death of this man. And so they do by ripping their clothes. Verse 12, they mourned, they wept, they fasted until evening for Saul and for Jonathan his son and for the people of He Who Is and for the house of Israel because they had fallen by the sword. So they are grieving over the whole tragedy of the defeat at Mount Gilboa. They finish with their grieving, the beginning of their official grieving by the end of the day. Remember, Jewish days, Israeli days, end at sunset and a new day begins. So as soon as the sun goes down, their initial day of grieving has finished. And so David decides that he needs to take care of this Amalekite problem. So David said to the young man who told him, "Where do you come from?" And he answered, "I'm the son of a sojourner and a Amalekite." Now, when he says a sojourner, he means somebody who's living inside the boundaries of Israel. But he definitely says, "I'm an Amalekite." David said to him, "How is it that you were not afraid to put your hand to destroy He Who Is His anointed?" So basically, how is it that you've been living in our country, knowing that this is the King of Israel, anointed by our God through His high priest, and you had no qualms of killing the man? And so David called one of the young men, so this would be one of the younger soldiers that attends to David, and said, "Go, execute him." And so he struck him down so that he died. And David said to him, before he's executed, "Your blood be on your own head, for your own mouth has testified against you. I have killed He Who Is His anointed." So if I am correct, and I feel very strongly I am, that this young man lied and was hoping to use that lie to get good treatment from the new king of Israel, it definitely blew up in his face because he is now a dead man executed for the crime of regicide, the death of a king, the death of the anointed one of God. Verse 17. David lamented with this lamentation over Saul and Jonathan his son. So we already know that David is an inspired prophet of God, inspired not just simply in his words, but in his music. So in this probably 7 to 30 day period of grief that he observes over the death of King Saul and Prince Jonathan and the other princes, he picks up his lyre, he picks up his musical instrument, and he composes this song of grief and this song of honor for the occasion. Verse 18, "And he said that it should be taught to the people of Judah, 'Behold, it is written in the book of Yasher.'" Now, Yasher means upright. It shows up from time to time this book of Yasher shows up as a kind of a source of material for our inspired written word. So probably a prophet of God was involved in writing these things down, and then that's where they get incorporated into the inspired text of the word that we know. And this is what it says. And remember, I always tell you when we come to a psalm, because this is a psalm of a sort, when we come to a psalm, we need to feel it. We need to let the emotion of it wash over us. Okay? Your glory, O Israel, is slain on your high places. How the mighty have fallen. So the glory here stands in for the royal party, King Saul and his princes, and how they were killed there on Mount Gilboa. Tell it not in Gath. Publish it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines rejoice, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised exult. So even though this is definitely happening, because the head of King Saul is making the rounds of the five cities of the Philistines, even as he's writing this psalm, and they are celebrating the death of their enemy in Israel. David says, don't let that happen. I don't want to think about that happening. Verse 21, you mountains of Gilboa, let there be no dew or rain upon you, nor fields of offerings. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled, the shield of Saul not anointed with oil. So he puts a little mini curse, poetically, metaphorically, upon the very area that these men were killed at. He doesn't want there to have any rain on it. He doesn't want it to have any dew on it. He wants it to just dry up, because that's where the equipment fell out of the hands of these men as they died. The shield of Saul didn't go with him at the end of that battle back home to Gibeah, where it would be oiled after it was cleaned and then put away for the next battle. It just laid there on the field of Gilboa. From the blood of the slain, from the fat of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan turned not back, and the sword of Saul returned not empty. So he imagines these two men that he's honoring with these words, King Saul and Prince Jonathan, fighting to the very bitter end. He sees Jonathan in his mind's eye, just repeatedly pulling back his bowstring and sending out another arrow against the enemy. And Saul is there, whacking away with his sword, fighting. And I have no doubt that David had seen this very thing happening on more than one occasion as all three of them fought together against the Philistines, against Ammonites, against the enemies of Israel, against the enemies of the Lord. But this time David wasn't there, and all he can do is imagine what it was like as they kept fighting until they couldn't fight any longer. And so he puts it in the song. Saul and Jonathan, beloved and lovely, in life and in death they were not divided. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. And I shared with you before my own grief that Jonathan would not leave his father's side and follow David. Even though he confessed that David would be the next king, he believed that he would be at David's side as his partner, as his associate after his own father's death. But Jonathan apparently felt it was imperative that he stick around with his father. I think he was hoping to redeem him. And so that puts him with his father on the day that his father received the judgment of God. Verse 24, you daughters of Israel. Weep over Saul, who clothed you luxuriously in scarlet, who put ornaments of gold on your apparel. So he tells the ladies, you need to weep over the man that made your economy better, who gave you nice clothes because of the things that he did for your country. Verse 25, how the mighty have fallen in the midst of the battle. And then we have this little special thanksgiving and praise regarding Jonathan. Jonathan lies slain on your high places. I am distressed for you, my brother Jonathan. So he is grieving very strongly over Jonathan, because Jonathan was the crown prince, probably just in his early 20s, when David killed Goliath and became someone that Jonathan felt a kindred spirit with. And so Jonathan took him under his arms and under his wing, and became his mentor, became his associate in fighting, and eventually became his close friend. And so Jonathan's death really hits David hard. Very pleasant have you been to me. Your love to me was extraordinary, surpassing the love of women. Now, I am very angry with those that try to say here that this is a confession of some sort of homosexual relationship. It is not. This is, exactly as I am framing it, a man who is grieving over the loss of a comrade, a big brother figure, a best friend, and he wants to express it being even stronger than the tie of marriage that David has only recently been experiencing himself. How the mighty have fallen, and the weapons of war perished. And so that is David's ode, his psalm of praise and honor on behalf of the late King Saul, Prince Jonathan, and the other princes as well. 2 Samuel, chapter number 2. After this, so after the period of grief, certainly at least 7 days, more likely 30 days of grief, David inquired of he who is. Now, when we hear that phrase, when we see that phrase in the text, we know that David has the young high priest in his entourage. And that high priest has the ephod, which is the uniform of the high priest that has the chest piece with the pocket behind it, in which is the Urim and the Thummim, the two stones that are used to inquire of God. So after the period of grief, David calls the high priest and asks him to bring out the Urim and Thummim so that David could ask the question, shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? So should I set up my headquarters, my capital as the king inside the tribal region of Judah? Because that's what Saul had done as the first king of Israel. He just simply used his hometown of Gibeah as his capital city. So what does God say back? He who is said to him, go up. So yes, go to a city in Judah. David then said, "To which shall I go up?" And again, remember the way the Urim and the Thummim work. The high priest puts the stones in his hand, the question is asked, and one of the stones glows according to Jewish tradition, and I think that actually makes the best sense according to the text. And so you have to ask, shall we go up to Bethlehem, for example, which I think may have been the first thing to be asked, because that is David's hometown. That was where he was born. And if that's the case, then God's answer would have been no. Now, the next most natural place to ask a question about is the one that comes up next. He said, to Hebron, because Hebron is the most significant city inside the tribal region of Judah. It is where the tombs of the patriarchs and the matriarchs are located at the cave of Machpelah. It's the place that Caleb took as the most famous spy of the tribe of Judah. And so I think it's reasonable that David may have asked about Bethlehem first, but then it makes good sense to me he would have asked about Hebron next. So he said to Hebron, and God apparently says yes, because we are told, so David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel, the Jezreel of Judah, not the Jezreel up in the north, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. Again, not Carmel, the mountain up in the north, but Carmel, a community that is in the wilderness region to the east, possibly southeast of Hebron. So he takes his two wives, and he brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they went and lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah.